Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Noam Chomsky is professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he has taught for over 50 years. He's also a renowned political activist and writer. His scores of books on linguistics, human rights, economics, and politics include Manufacturing Consent, Necessary Illusions, Hegemony or Survival, 9-1-1, and his latest, Occupy. Welcome, Noam Chomsky.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I was lucky enough, as I was thinking of doing this interview, to live in Cambridge and Boston most of the time from 65 to 73. And so I participated in a number of demonstrations back then where you and the late Howard Zinn exhorted us to demand an end to the war in Vietnam. And I felt very lucky to be in that moment at that time. And I thought of those days when I saw you were visiting the demonstrators at Occupy Wall Street and some of the other sites, Occupy Boston and so on. And just tell me a little bit about what, just to set this up, what that experience was for you.
You're referring to the early experience or the current one?
No, the current one.
Well, the current, first of all, it's there are a great many, actually. The first time that Howard Zinn and I jointly attended a demonstration was in the early 60s down in Jackson, Mississippi, and there have been innumerable cases since. In fact, it's practically hard to think of a year that went by without one or several. There's constant concern about a wide variety of very serious issues and organization and activism related to it, and sometimes they're associated with demonstrations. Now, the Occupy movement is somewhat different. That wasn't a one-day demonstration in Washington or the kind of demonstration you took part in Boston and Cambridge back in the 60s and early 70s, but it was, as the name indicates, an Occupy movement. Public space was taken, used for an extensive period until, predictably, it was broken up by the security system, although the movement continues and moves into other, takes on other forms. But it was a large-scale, permanent, intended to be permanent organization, set of actions which are related to really fundamental questions of the society, not ending a particular atrocity like the war in Vietnam or the war against Nicaragua in the 1980s or the civil rights issues
or apartheid,
yes,
and so
on, but ongoing permanent fundamental properties of the whole social system which are reaching an aggravated form today.
Okay, and one thing that I've heard you say about this movement is that I'm going to read a quote of yours, that the Occupy movement is unprecedented seems appropriate because this is an unprecedented era, not just at this moment, but since the 1970s. And you make a point of the difference of the American mood during the Depression in the 30s and today. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I'm old enough to remember the Depression, which objectively was far worse than today. And a lot of my family were directly involved, a working-class family, many unemployed, and some barely gone through school and so on. But the conditions were much worse. But there was a very different mood and attitude. I'm not just referring to the family, but quite generally. There was a sense of hopefulness, a sense that we're doing something constructive, we have ways of getting out of this, and we'll get out of it together. There was a lot of solidarity, mutual support. The union movement had revived after it had been pretty much crushed by Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare, and barely, it was staggering in the 1920s, but it revived. It was at the forefront of a major activities that led to the New Deal legislation, which, though it didn't end the Depression, depression was nevertheless very significant. Its lasting effects right until today. But in general, there was a feeling that it's going to get better. We're going to get out of it. Manufacturing jobs may have declined, but they're coming back, and we're going to have a better society in the future. That's quite different from today. Today, there's a sense of a general sense that things are going completely in the wrong way, but that there's nothing much we can do about it. It's hopeless. There's a sense, and there's a lot of anger in the country, but it's unfocused and unorganized. And the Occupy movement's one of the first concerted efforts to try to respond to this. And the concerns are in a sense very real. So manufacturing jobs this time are not going to come back as long as policies persist on their current course. Nothing inevitable about that. But the design of policies, and it is design, since the 1970s, have essentially reversed centuries of American history from its origins. The colonies and the independent country were moving forward towards growth, industrialization, development, better society in the future. We don't want to overlook the fact that the methods used were often vicious and destructive, and there were, of course, it wasn't steady progress. There was much regression, but that was the general trajectory. You could expect things to get better later on. Not now. Not as policy is currently designed, pretty much since the shift in the 1970s towards an economy based critically on financial manipulations and offshoring of production and other consequences that followed from that. So the mood, but the general mood of the population is quite different, and with some justice. If it leads to apathy, anger, irrational responses, new forms of authoritarianism, attacks on one another, and so on, and one can see signs of all of that, it could be very dangerous. The Occupy movement is a constructive and potentially very significant response to it.
Yeah, let me one thing that you were mentioning in there. For years prior to the last few, folks talked about the movement of manufacturing overseas and the shift at home from a production economy to a service economy. And we heard a lot of talk about knowledge workers, that sort of thing. But for most of that time, I do not recall people pointing out that the real money and the real impact of this service economy was the enormous growth of the financial sector. And you link those two very clearly. Could you talk about that just a bit?
Well, yes, there were very good economists and many other people who did talk about it, but they're on the fringes, you're right. So, for example, I won't go through the record, but there are people who were pointing out right from the beginning that the extensive growth of the financial institutions from the 1970s was setting in motion a vicious cycle which has led to extreme concentration of wealth, mostly in the financial sector. The top one-tenth of 1% of the population is spectacularly wealthy, and pretty much stagnation for the majority of the population, often decline, increasing of work hours, increasing decline and attacks on the weak benefit system. All of this took off under Reagan. It's continued since, and it's combined. It leads almost inexorably to a shredding of the political system. As economic power concentrates, so does political power, which leads to legislative action, administrative methods that simply accelerate the cycle, and that's the situation we're now in. Now, there were those who pointed it out, in fact, analyzed it in detail, actually. I've been writing about it myself for 30 years, but there's much more detailed and extensive work. But it has been marginalized, you're correct. And one of the things the Occupy movement has achieved is to bring it to the center of attention.
Yeah, you've called the 1% and the 99% the plutonomy and the precariat. And what do you mean by those terms?
Well, actually, I've borrowed the term.
I know. But
the term plutonomy was produced by Citibank, you know, they're the big, huge bank, which itself has been the beneficiary of enormous government largesse since the early Reagan years.
And came into existence through a change in federal policy.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
The new one came in, the current Citibank is actually the related closely to the breakdown of Glass-Steagall.
Exactly.
Actually, it slightly preceded it, but in the expectation that Glass-Steagall would be eliminated, which it then was by the Clinton administration, creating this monstrosity, which continues to live on repeated taxpayer subsidy, but incidentally, that's been going on since the early 80s, its predecessor. Anyway, and I think it was 2005, they produced a brochure for investors in which they advised them to invest in what they called the plutonomy, the small sector of the global population, highly concentrated in the United States and a couple other rich countries, a small percentage which is way at the top of the income ladder, wealth ladder. And they pointed out that those are the profitable investments. That's where the action is. And they have what they call a plutonomy index, you know, which advises investors on how to invest for this segment of the population, which goes back quite a few years. And they pointed out that it's been exceeding the stock market by quite a considerable amount. So what they're urging is, look, focus your attention on a tiny percentage of the global population, highly concentrated in the United States and England, you know, small in Saudi Arabia, in China, a couple other places, and let that be. That's where the future is for the economy. Well, what about the rest? Well, here there's another term which has a different origin: precariat. It's those who live a precarious existence. Well, I won't go through the history of the term, which is interesting, but in the current stage of, you know, the global economy, that's most of the population. They're living in a precarious existence. And this is very conscious. So Alan Greenspan, who was just lauded by the economics profession as one of the greatest geniuses ever, presided over an economy of which he was very proud and of which the economic profession was very proud, right up practically to the moment of the latest crash, and he had explained very clearly what his great achievement was based on. He testified to Congress during the Clinton years that one of the secrets of his success was imposing greater worker insecurity, growing worker insecurity, which has the consequence that working people don't press for decent wages, for decent working conditions, are afraid they may lose their jobs, and so on. They're kind of passive, beaten, subordinated, all of which is great for the economy from a certain point of view. So that's it was a conscious, this is just a description of a conscious effort, of which he's one of the agents, but it goes back to the developments that I mentioned in the 70s.
One of the things that's remarkable about those two terms is that, as you say, both of them were coined by the 1% as positive terms.
Well, actually, precariat goes back farther.
But, well, I mean,
I'm using it this way. It's not the general way it's used.
But I'm saying Greenspan pointing to that as an achievement.
Yeah, he was pointing to growing worker insecurity as one of the core features of his success, of which he was very proud. And yes, that fits the concept of precariat, people living a precarious existence. At first, it was coined for people on the fringe of society. But now it's society.
Right. I'm speaking with Noam Chomsky. I'm Terrence McNally, and we're Noam Chomsky, author, activist, scholar, professor of linguistics at MIT, has been speaking truth to power for at least half a century, and we're talking about current issues, and he has a new book/pamphlet, Occupy, and you can learn more at chomsky.info or ZuccottiParkPress.com. Let's return to one. Oh, I want to raise one more major issue. Another thing that you've spoken about, in which all of this, I think, is just setting the context for Occupy. Here's another quote of yours. Practically every country in the world is taking at least halting steps to do something about climate change. The United States is taking steps backward. A propaganda system, openly acknowledged by the business community, declares climate change is all a liberal hoax. Why pay attention to these scientists? If this intransigence continues in the richest, most powerful country in the world, the catastrophe will not be averted. Your thoughts about that big issue that is also somehow being held back by the 1%?
It most definitely is, and very frankly and openly. They don't keep it secret. So a couple of years ago, the Chamber of Commerce, the main business lobby, the American Petroleum Institute, a couple of other major business lobbies and organizations announced quite openly that they are conducting a campaign. They may have called it an education campaign, but it means a propaganda campaign, to convince the public that they don't have to be concerned about global warming. The science is questioned, and in fact, they were modeling themselves on the great campaigns of the tobacco lobby and the lead producers and others, which delayed for decades actions that should have been taken immediately to avert an enormous human catastrophes. I mean, huge numbers of people killed. And they were making the same claims. Well, the science isn't certain, and, maybe this and that, and so on. Well, they're going to use the same methods to try to convince people that they can forget about global warming. And it's been effective. It's there are international polls of concern over global warming. And the United States, it's reasonably high in the United States, but considerably less than other industrial countries. And that's in substantial measure a result of these very effective propaganda campaigns.
I subscribe to, I'm forgetting exactly who it is, I think they call themselves the National Center, but it's one of the right-wing think tanks. And I've been getting emails lately. I subscribe to their emails just to see what's going on. And they are at stockholder meetings. They are going in front of, they are having stockholders stand up and say, you are neglecting your shareholder by making by taking actions towards sustainability, by taking actions toward energy efficiency. Yep. and climate change, and they are proudly going in and saying, how do you defend this kind of action?
Yeah, no, that's quite true, and the consequences are very real. Very recently, there was a study of attitudes of 18 to 24 year olds, and it was pretty shocking. One result related to this is that there was a question on climate change. The question was, do you think the government ought to take some action on climate change if it might impede growth? 28% thought that it should.
Wow.
Of course, the question is ridiculously put. You can have economic growth that helps overcome climate change. So if you develop solar energy, something as simple as weatherization of houses, high-speed rail, and so on, that's growth. But it has a positive effect on the environment. But putting that aside, the idea that less than a third of young people think it's important enough to do something about, that's a very shocking indication of the success of these massive propaganda campaigns. You see it in the media, for example. I mean, the media do cover these issues, but it's usually covered in what they like to call an objective manner, meaning there's two sides. On the one side is 98% of scientists. On the other side is a few change skeptics, a couple of whom are serious scientists, but very few, and Jim Inhofe and the Senator Inhofe and a couple of others. And so you're left, the person who reads it is left with the impression, well, you know, it's uncertain, why should we do anything? Incidentally, omitted from these discussions almost universally are a very substantial number of scientists, serious climate scientists, who are also skeptics, but because they think that the international consensus is much too conservative.
Mm, exactly. Yeah. So let's shift now to Occupy. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Noam Chomsky. What is your sense of what's new in this movement and the broad actions and ideas that it's inspired? What is working?
Well, I think there are two major... first of all, I think the movement has been, we should recognize, spectacularly successful. It's only been a few months, and it's had a major impact already. So whatever happens from now on in, I think it's been of extreme importance. And in two respects, one has to do with policy issues, roughly. So shall we do something? What should we do about the kinds of things that you and I have just been talking about, the enormous inequality, the undermining of a productive economy, the shredding of the political process, elections being even more openly bought than they were in the past. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's changed considerably. What should we do about the environment? All these questions. There's a range of important policy questions. The other aspect, which has been less discussed, but I think is quite significant, is simply the fact that the Occupy movements kind of spontaneously developed communities of solidarity and support and open spaces for discussion and debate. If you went to Zuccotti Park or almost any of the others, there are there were health programs, libraries, just a whole range of structures developed in which people were cooperating with each other, helping each other, creating bonds and associations and opening spaces for discussion. Well, that's just something extremely important, especially in a society like ours, where there have been enormous efforts for a long, long time to try to atomize the society, to try to separate people from one another, to try to create a kind of social system in which each person is basically out for himself or herself, and you don't care about others, and you don't deal with others. This goes back to the origins of the industrial system, the effort to impose such structures, and it's been pursued quite effectively with large-scale consequences. Actually, it shows up in that poll of young people that I described mm-hmm. before, but we see it all around us. It's a very atomized society. You're supposed to be focused on maximizing your own consumer goods and your own wealth, and what happens to others is none of your business. And there's also been a destruction of what social scientists call secondary associations, structures in which people get together, communicate, interact, make decisions, choices, help one another, and so on. Unions were a major element of this, one of the reasons for the tremendous attack on unions since actually always, but picking up substantially in recent years. And others, too. I mean, there's some left, like church groups and so on, but it's very narrow. Now, the development of such kind of social organizations within the Occupy movement is extremely significant. If that can be spread and broadened to larger segments of the society, it would change things considerably.
Yeah, in one sense, the 99%, 1%, the focus on economic domination, etc., is an idea. is an idea. This other thing is a way of living, and both of them seem to have, you know, come alive in the Occupy movement. What do you think are the greatest challenges facing the Occupy or 99% movement as we move forward?
Well, the Occupy tactic turned out to be kind of a brilliant one. Frankly, I wouldn't have anticipated it. I'm as surprised as anyone else. But it did work very well. However, tactics have this. First of all, tactics typically have a kind of a, you know, they yield diminishing returns. They sort of have a half-life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they work, they work well for a period, but then that declines. A second concern is that there's a kind of a tendency for tactics, tactical choices and sometimes tactical successes to shift the consciousness of participants so that the tactic becomes the crucial issue, not what the tactic is for, and you have to guard against that. Anyhow, I think it's in a stage now where, and I'm not saying anything that Occupy activists don't know, it's in a stage now where the tactics have to be adjusted and modified with the issues kept foremost and new modes of approaching the issues developed, which will carry the whole movement forward in both of the respects that we've been discussing, both on the roughly policy side and on the creation of community side. And that's a hard task. It's not one that's going to be, it's not a victory that you can hope for in a day. It's worth looking at the history of activist movements here. They teach us a lot. So take, for example, the civil rights movement. Beginning, you know, it goes way back, but taking off in the early 60s. And just think about its history. Think about, say, Martin Luther King, who was kind of the symbol of the civil rights movement. There's a commemoration every year of Martin Luther King Day. And if you listen to the speeches and the rhetoric and, you know, the celebrations and so on of this great figure, it pretty much terminates in 1963
mm-hmm.
with the I Have a Dream speech. Well, actually, there was a different I Have a Dream speech, which is rarely, if ever, mentioned. That was the evening that he was assassinated. He was in Memphis to support a strike of sanitation workers, public service workers, and he was on his way to the next move that was planned was a march from Memphis to Washington, where the hope was to, his hope and intention was to try to consolidate a movement of the poor. In fact, right after the assassination, it took place. It was led by his wife, Coretta King. They went through the, starting from the motel where he was killed, it went through the places in the South that where the great struggles had been, ended up in Washington, where the marchers put up a city, a tent city called Resurrection City, and that was to be the takeoff, that was kind of an Occupy that would be the takeoff for the Poor People's Movement. Well, it didn't last very long. Congress, which is the most liberal Congress in American history, sent in the security forces, which demolished Resurrection City at night and drove the marchers out of the city. Well, that was a that was the culmination of a very radical shift in Northern liberal attitudes towards King after 1963. And it was tied to something quite straightforward. King didn't regard himself as finished with voting rights in the South. He moved on right away, you know, by the mid-60s, to try to address, to organize the huge civil rights movement, to address fundamental problems of urban America and rural America, too, but primarily in the cities. Poverty, segregation, repression, very harsh treatment of minorities and the poor people generally and so on. And he also turned then very quickly to criticism of the U.S. war in Vietnam, and that was too much. He was raising class issues, which would affect the wealthy and the privileged, and he was criticizing U.S. Government policy, which was strongly supported at that time, you have to remember, by liberal opinion, intellectual opinion generally. Later there was, you know, claims, well, it's costing us too much and so on. But then condemnation was very harshly harshly repressed.
Yeah, one of the things I hear in what you're saying, actually, is that we keep him in the box of having only cared about race relations, whereas poverty and America's empire are issues that cut across race. And
that wasn't, that's even too broad. As long as King and the civil rights movement were focusing on racist sheriffs in Alabama and deprivation of voting rights in Mississippi, then it was tolerated and even praised. But when it turned back home, that changed. And that also includes racist, plenty of racism, which shows up in other ways. And just the general structural violence of the society.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as he turned to that, attitudes towards him changed substantially. And that part of his life and, up to Resurrection City and so on is pretty much wiped out of consciousness. But that's now to get back to Occupy.
Right.
That's what they're addressing, the things that were not tolerated at the time, even by Northern liberal opinion at the time of the civil rights movement. So it's going to be a lot harder. These are much harder issues to address.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not criticizing somebody else's crimes. It's home. It's right at home.
Home in the North, home in the Northeast, home in the academic,
privileged, educated,
in the privileged, educated sector. Yeah, you have said, because my question really next is how would you, from a vantage point of having been involved, in movements and so on for all these years, advise them to confront these challenges? And let me just read a couple of things you've said. You said, if you're a serious revolutionary, you're not looking for an autocratic revolution, but a popular one, which will move towards freedom and democracy. This can take place only if a mass of the population are implementing it, carrying it out, solving problems. They're not going to undertake that commitment unless they have discovered for themselves that there are limits to reform. And you if you want to change the world, you'd better try to understand it. That doesn't mean listening to a talk or reading a book. You learn from participating. So your advice to this broad, diffuse movement that we might call the 99%.
Well, what you quoted, I think I would continue to endorse, but it's very general advice. It's not specific advice. Hard question is how you proceed to do this. Well, I think there are a lot of things that can be done, ranging over quite a broad spectrum, in fact. So, for example, things that the parts of the Occupy movement are doing, like concentrating on preventing foreclosures, mobilizing people to support those who are being penalized for the crimes of the banking industry and others in the early 90s, and the government participating with them, including the Greenspans and so on. The victims are the people who are being tossed out of their homes, or the victims are the 20 to 30 year old kids who are not getting jobs. If you go for years without employment, your life is very seriously harmed. All sorts of ways, elderly people too. Unemployment is a real curse and has all sorts of consequences. So addressing those issues directly is, and there's a whole range of them, are things that the Occupy movement can do. And then there are more far-reaching things, which potentially would be revolutionary, but can be done right now. So, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the same talk was worker-owned industry, worker-owned, worker community-owned enterprises. That can be developed, and in fact, it is being developed. There's many examples throughout the country. They could be extended. They could be extended quite far. In fact, it was just recently an agreement between the United Steelworkers Union and the huge Mondragon cooperative collective conglomerate in northern Spain, which is the most successful and large-scale worker-owned industrial, not just, I mean, system. It includes industry, manufacturing, banking, schools, homes, and so on. I mean, there are problems with it, but it's a very significant large-scale development, and their linkage with a major U.S. union in an effort to try to develop similar things here, that could be really important, along with the enterprise system that's developing. One of the people who's done the most work on this, has also written about it very importantly, is Gar Alperovitz.
Mm-hmm.
But that's right in front of us right now. Things like that can be done. Of course, typically on a small scale, but small-scale changes provide models and inspiration to others to proceed. So there's a whole range of things that you can turn to, and but it should be understood that these are not going to be quick victories.
Yeah, this is a long-term or generational thing. You know, one of the things I was going to say is the looking toward the Mondragon cooperatives is exciting to me because, and I'd love you to comment on this. I find Americans, even progressives, to me, amazingly ignorant and blind of things happening in other countries, of even, for instance, that whatever one may think about the German system. In Germany, if you're a corporation of 2,000 employees, half the board is elected by the workers.
Yeah.
Americans, as far as I know, have no idea of this. The whole healthcare debate went on, and there was never a question of how do other systems actually work. It was, you know, demonized. And what is it about America that makes us so, as I say, even progressives can't see that there are alternatives happening, practicing, developing elsewhere, and we seem so blind to them?
Well, the United States has always been a very insular society for lots of reasons. In the modern period, it's related to the fact that the country is uniquely powerful and overwhelmingly secure. There's nothing like it in history. There isn't in, you know, you have to manufacture enemies. The United States pretty much controls it. It has been, things are interestingly changing, but in the whole modern period, it's been totally dominant in the hemisphere. It's controlled both oceans. It's pretty much controlled the opposite sides of both oceans. It's far richer than others, has much greater advantages than others. A lot of this is declining, but it's been the case for a long, long time. And that leads to a sense that we just don't have to pay attention to anyone else. If you look at knowledge of what Americans know about other countries, even about geography, about history, I mean, it's kind of abysmal. And it's, in a way, kind of natural. Like, if you're living in Europe, say, or in most of the world, you travel a short distance, you're running into other languages, other cultures, other social practices, and so on. You travel from, say, Boston, where I live, to Los Angeles. You take a flight, you're in the same place where you started. The airport is exactly the same. The stores are the same. The people may have a slightly different accent, but it's basically the same. That's quite unusual. And it does tend, all of this tends to yield a form of insularity and also a sense of superiority. Why do we have to know anything about these other backward people out there? Because we're so much advanced. That's been there's also a conception of what's called American exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
That goes way back. It's in somehow it begins, you know, back in the 1620s. We're going to be the city on the hill,
right?
You know? And right up till today, there's something special about us. We're following God. We're specially chosen by Providence, by God to, you know, lead the way for the rest of the world. We're the light unto the nations, you know, the modern Israel, and so on and so forth. It's not, incidentally, unique to the United States. The British had quite similar conceptions in their day in the sun, and sort of the French and their smaller imperial system and so on. But in the United States, it's a very powerful force, and based on elements of reality, the country was uniquely advantaged. As soon as you destroyed and exterminated the indigenous population, it was and brought in, you know, slaves to create the basis for the, you know, cotton text, the early industrial revolution, and so on. You had a tremendous advantages that other countries didn't have, and it's the history of the country has been one of a conquest and repression. First, conquest of the national territory, which means constant war and destruction to drive out or sometimes exterminate the indigenous population. All of that, incidentally, and then, you know, conquest of half of Mexico, expansion into the Pacific, conquest of robbery of Hawaii from its own population, conquest of the Philippines, and after the Second World War, just, you know, enormous power. And, you know, it's all forgotten. It's not just that we don't know about other countries. We don't know about ourselves. So just to give one striking example, the United Nations has a... there is an effort within the United Nations to investigate the state of indigenous populations, which are usually pretty harshly repressed, and to do something about it. Well, you know, the chief investigator, who happens to be a U.S. citizen of Indian ancestry, incidentally, he just conducted the first inquiry into the state of Native Americans. Did you read about it?
Not a word.
Not a word. I mean, there were a few comments on it, you know, disparaging the United Nations. What do these crazy baboons have to do with looking into our magnificent society and so on? But the idea that there was an enormous crime, which the Founding Fathers were instantly well aware of, described it, and the people who carried it out, there was a horrible crime. It cleared the country of its indigenous population. They're driven into reservations where they live in awful conditions. But the idea that anybody could even ask a question about this is considered so outrageous that either we can't talk about it at all or else we just dismiss it with contempt.
Well, one of the things that I found, just again, when these things happen, it amazes me, and then I get over my amazement, was that it seemed in the Republican debates this year, whatever one may think of Obama, one of the criticisms was that he did not believe strongly enough in American exceptionalism.
That's right.
That's reason to, you know, to get rid of him, because he doesn't buy into this. Now that I've mentioned Obama and those debates, 2012 is an election year, and you've described the national elections as a public relations extravaganza. Let me ask one question first, and then if you want to say more, if we want to go more into that, because as I say, this is an election year, let's. But because our political process and the government it delivers are so owned and dominated by the wealthy and the biggest corporations, I feel there's a gap, a disconnect of identification, of engagement, of influence, of trust between the people and the politics, and between the people and the government. In this election year, how can the Occupy 99% movement best occupy that gap?
I think it's very among the problems that the Occupy movement is facing right now are the very fact that an election is taking place. In these electoral, the elections in the United States have increasingly become public relations extravaganzas. Issues are put way to the side. It focuses on personalities, on anything that doesn't matter. And there are good reasons for that, because there are great gaps between popular opinion and preferred public policy by elite sectors. extravaganza, a huge amount of publicity, billions of dollars of expenditures. People are just kind of trapped into it. And I think it's important. Significant activism tends to decline in an election year for this reason. Now, you can't ignore the fact that it's taking place, but I think it's important to try to find ways of acting which will keep from being trapped into the electoral extravaganza and continue with the significant actions. Now, it also is worth taking a position on the elections. I mean, my own view is that I'm hardly a fan of Obama's. Nevertheless, if there was a Republican victory in the election, meaning not just the president, but all the way down the line, it would be extremely harmful to the country. The Republican Party years ago has ceased to be a normal political party, parliamentary party. It's now a kind of a caricature of the old Communist Party. It has a catechism that everyone has to repeat rigorously, most of it probably crazy. You have to vote in lockstep uniform. You have to block anything that might be beneficial to the general population. Total service to the wealthy and privileged in the corporate sector, combined with all kinds of Orwellian rhetoric about how they are the job creators and all the rest of it. It's a kind of a it's a fanatically ideological religious organization. It happens to base itself a lot on Christian extremists, but it's just in the political sense the way it acts, and it could be very dangerous. I mean, things are bad enough at the moment. This could push it completely in the extremely dangerous direction. So I think it's worth taking a stand on the elections, but keeping it to a kind of like an issue of 10th order significance. There are many other, it takes 5 minutes to take a stand and turn to important topics. To try to do that during an election year with the huge PR public relations extravaganza going on is not easy, but it's something that has to be done. Listen, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take off.
Okay. I really appreciate the time you've given us. The new book pamphlet is Occupy. You can learn more at Chomsky.info, which is a wonderful site with enormous information, and at ZuccottiParkPress.com. They're the publishers of Occupy. Thank you, Noam Chomsky, and it almost goes without saying, keep up the good work.
Well, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.